This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents My Life on the Road by Gloria Steinem. Read for you by Deborah Winger. Dedication, Prelude, and Introduction read by the author.
This book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India. Knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate, he said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life." Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you. This is a quote from Bruce Chatwin, Anatomy of Restlessness. Evolution intended us to be travelers. Settlement for any length of time, in cave or castle, has at best been a drop in the ocean of evolutionary time. Prelude. I board a plane for Rapid City, South Dakota, and see a lot of people in black leather, chains, and tattoos. Airline passengers usually look like where they're going. Business suits to Washington, D.C., jeans to L.A., but I can't imagine a convention of such unconventional visitors in Rapid City. It's the kind of town where people still angle park their cars in front of the movie palace. My bearded seatmate is asleep in his studded jacket and nose ring, so I just accept one more mystery of the road. At the airport, I meet five friends from different parts of the country. We are a diverse group of women, a Cherokee activist and her grown-up daughter, two African-American writers and one musician, and me. We've been invited to a Lakota Sioux powwow celebrating the powerful place that women held before patriarchy arrived from Europe, and efforts now to restore that place. As we drive toward the Badlands, we see an acre of motorcycles around each isolated diner and motel. This solves the mystery of the leather and the chains, but creates another. When we stop for coffee, our waitress can't believe we don't know. Every August since 1938, bikers from all over the world have come here for a rally named after Sturgis, a town that's just a wide place in the road. They are drawn by this sparsely populated space of forests, mountains, and a grid of highways so straight that it is recognizable from outer space. Right now, about 250,000 bikers are filling every motel and campground within 500 miles. Our band of six strong women takes note. The truth is, we are a little afraid of so many bikers in one place. How could we not be? We have all learned from movies that bikers travel in packs, treat their women like possessions, and may see other women as sexual fair game. But we don't run into the bikers because we spend our days traveling down unmarked roads past the last stand of trees in Indian country. We eat home-cooked food brought in trucks, sit on blankets around powwow grounds where dancers follow the heartbeat of drums, and watch Indian ponies as decorated as the dancers. When it rains, a rainbow stretches from can't see to can't see, and fields of wet sweetgrass become as fragrant as gigantic flowers. Only when we return late each night to our cabins do we see motorcycles in the parking lot. While walking in Rapid City, I hear a biker say to his tattooed woman partner, "Honey, shop as long as you want. I'll meet you at the cappuccino place." I assume this is an aberration. On our last morning, I enter the lodge alone for an early breakfast, trying to remain both inconspicuous and open-minded. Still, I'm hyper-conscious of a room full of knife sheaths, jackboots, and very few women. In the booth next to me, a man with chains around his muscles and a woman in leather pants and an improbable hairdo are taking note of my presence. Finally, the woman comes over to talk. I just want to tell you, she says cheerfully, how much Ms. Magazine has meant to me over the years. And my husband, too. He reads some now that he's retired. But what I wanted to ask, isn't one of the women you're traveling with Alice Walker? I love her poetry. It turns out that she and her husband have been coming to this motorcycle rally every year since they were first married. She loves the freedom of the road and also the mysterious moonscape of the Badlands. She urges me to walk there, but to follow the paths marked by ropes. During the war over the sacred Black Hill, she explains, Lakota warriors found refuge there because the cavalry got lost every time. Her husband stops by on his way to the cashier and suggests I see the huge statue of Crazy Horse that's being dynamited out of the Black Hills. Crazy Horse riding his pony, he says, is going to make all those Indian-killing presidents on Mount Rushmore look like nothing. He walks away, a gentle, lumbering man, tattoos, chains, and all. Before she leaves, my new friend tells me to look out the big picture window at the parking lot. See that purple Harley out there, the big gorgeous one? That's mine. I used to ride behind my husband and never took the road on my own. Then after the kids were grown, I put my foot down. It was hard, but we finally got to be partners. Now he says he likes it better this way. He doesn't have to worry about his bike breaking down or getting a heart attack and totaling us both. I even put Ms. on my license plate. And you should see my grandkids' faces when Grandma rides up on her purple Harley. On my own again, I look out at the barren sand and tortured rocks of the Badlands stretching for miles. I've walked there, and I know that close up, the barren sand reveals layers of pale rose and beige and cream, and the rocks turn out to have intricate womb-like openings. Even in the distant cliffs, caves of rescue appear. What seems to be one thing from a distance is very different close up. I tell you this story because it's the kind of lesson that can be learned only on the road, and also because I've come to believe that inside, each of us has a purple motorcycle. We have only to discover it and ride. Introduction. Road signs. When people ask me why I still have hope and energy after all these years, I always say, because I travel. For more than four decades, I've spent at least half my time on the road. I've never tried to write about this way of life, not even when I was reporting on people and events along the way. It just seemed to have no category. I wasn't on a Kerouac road trip, or rebelling before settling down, or even traveling for one cause. At first I was a journalist following stories, then a sometime worker in political campaigns and movements, and most consistently, an itinerant feminist organizer. I became a person whose friends and hopes were as spread out as my life. It just felt natural that the one common element in that life was the road. When friends or reporters assumed that spending so much time away from home was a hardship, I often asked them to travel with me, hoping they would get as hooked as I was. Yet in all these years, only one took me up on it for just 3 days. As decades passed and the word still entered my life, as in, oh, you're still traveling, it dawned on me that I'd been writing least about what I was doing most. So I sat down and began to make notes about many trips, past and present, that left me amazed by what is, angered by what isn't, and hooked on what could be. As I looked through old datebooks and schedules, letters, and abandoned journals, suddenly I was awash in a sense memory of my father going through his tattered road maps and address books, trying to figure out how much gas money he needed to get from here to there, where to find trailer parks that would shelter his wife and two daughters, and what roadside dealers might buy the small antiques which he sold and bartered as we made our way across the country. It was so vivid that I could sense our conspiratorial whispering as we tried not to wake my mother, who was asleep in this house trailer that was our home for most of each year. Until that moment, I would have sworn that I had rebelled against my father's way of life. I created a home that I love and can retreat to, though he wanted no home at all. I've never borrowed a penny, though he was constantly in debt. I take planes and trains to group adventures, though he would spend a week driving cross-country alone rather than board a plane. Yet in the way that we rebel only to find ourselves in the midst of the familiar, I realized there was a reason why the road felt like home. It had been exactly that for the evocative first decade of my life. I was my father's daughter. I never imagined starting this book with my father's life. Then I realized I had to. More discoveries followed. For instance, I always thought of my road life as temporary, assuming that one day I would grow up and settle down. Now I realize that for me, the road was permanent and settling down was temporary. Traveling had created my non-road life, not the other way around. Take public speaking. I spent all of my 20s and early 30s avoiding it. When I once asked a speech teacher about my aversion, she explained that dancers and writers were especially difficult to teach to speak in public, since both had chosen a profession in which they didn't have to talk. And I had been both. Then in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the editors I'd been freelancing for were gigantically uninterested in the explosion of feminism across the country. I finally got angry enough and desperate enough to partner with a woman who was much braver than I and to travel to campuses and community groups. Over time and far from home, I discovered something I might never otherwise have learned. People in the same room understand and empathize with each other in a way that isn't possible on the page or screen. Gradually, I became the last thing on earth I would ever have imagined, a public speaker and a gatherer of groups. And this brought an even bigger reward, public listening. It was listening that taught me there would be readers for a national feminist magazine no matter what publishing experts said. Up to then, I'd been a freelance writer who never wanted to work in an office or be responsible for anything other than my own rent. But because of what I learned on the road, I invited writers and editors to explore starting a feminist magazine that was devoted, in the words of the great Florence Kennedy, to making revolution, not just dinner. When those women also said they had no place to publish what they cared about most, Ms. Magazine was born. From then on, I came home to a magnetic office full of journalists and editors. Ms. gave me not only an added reason to go on the road, but a chosen family to return to after every trip, my pockets full of scribbled notes about new events. Altogether, I might never have had the will or the way to do any of the things that matter most to me had it not been for just being out there. Taking to the road, by which I mean letting the road take you, changed who I thought I was. The road is messy in the way that real life is messy. It leads us out of denial and into reality, out of theory and into practice, out of caution and into action, out of statistics and into stories, in short, out of our heads and into our hearts. It's right up there with life-threatening emergencies and truly mutual sex as a way of being fully alive in the present. As you can see, the first reason for this book is to share the most important, longest-running, yet least visible part of my life. It's my chance to do more than come home saying to friends, "I met an amazing person who," or "here's a great new idea for," or most of all, "we have to stop generalizing about the American people as if we were one homogeneous lump." I'm also now immune to politicians who say, "I've traveled the length and breadth of this great land, and I know." I've traveled more than any of them, and I don't know. What we're told about this country is way too limited by generalities, soundbites, and even the supposedly enlightened idea that there are two sides to every question. In fact, many questions have three or seven or a dozen sides. Sometimes I think the only real division into two is between people who divide everything into two, and those who don't. Altogether, if I'd been looking at nothing but the media all these years, I would be a much more discouraged person, especially given the notion that only conflict is news and that objectivity means being even-handedly negative. On the road, I learned that the media are not reality. Reality is reality. For instance, Americans are supposed to cherish freedom, yet we imprison a bigger percentage of our people than any other country in the world. I talk to students who are graduating in crippling debt, yet don't connect this to state legislatures that are building prisons we don't need instead of schools we do need, and then spending an average of $50,000 a year per prisoner and way less per student. I love the entrepreneurial spirit of people who start a high-tech company or a hot dog stand, but our income and wealth gaps are the biggest in the developed world. I meet people in Indian country who can trace their origins back 100,000 years and survivors of sex and labor trafficking who arrived yesterday. Also, this country is transforming before our eyes. In 30 years or so, the majority will no longer be European Americans. The first generation of mostly babies of color has already been born. This new diversity will give us a better understanding of the world and enrich our cultural choices. Yet there are people whose sense of identity depends on the old hierarchy. It may just be their fear and guilt talking. What if I am treated as I have treated others? But with all the power and money that is behind it, this backlash could imprison us in a hierarchy all over again. As Robin Morgan wrote so wisely, hate generalizes, love specifies. That's what makes going on the road so important. It definitely specifies. My second purpose is to encourage you to spend some time on the road too. By that I mean traveling or even living for a few days where you are in an on-the-road state of mind, not seeking out the familiar, but staying open to whatever comes along. It can begin the moment you leave your door. Like a jazz musician improvising, or a surfer looking for a wave or a bird riding a current of air, you'll be rewarded by moments when everything comes together. Listen to the story of strangers meeting in a snowstorm that Judy Collins sings about in The Blizzard, or read Alice Walker's essay, My Father's Country is the Poor. Each starts in a personal place, takes an unpredictable path, and reaches a destination that is both surprising and inevitable, like the road itself. An addiction to the road can exist anywhere. The Sufi poet Rumi's caravan wandered through a dozen Muslim lands, the Roma people left India for Europe and never settled down, and Australia's Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders go on walkabout to renew ancient songlines. I am writing this On the Road in America book because it's the place where I live and travel most, and most need to understand, especially given its outsized influence on the world. Also, I'm not sure that we can understand another country if we don't understand our own. In my 20s, I had the good luck to live for a year in Europe and then for 2 years in India. Yet in some ways, I was escaping more than being fully present. Secure Europe was a momentary way of leaving an insecure childhood behind. Faraway India helped to introduce me to the way most people live in the world, something way beyond anything I knew. I'm still thankful to that huge and struggling country for being impossible to ignore. Otherwise, I might have come home as the same person I was when I left. My purpose here is to tempt you to explore this country. American travel seems to need an advocate. If I'm going to Australia or Zambia, people tell me how exciting it is. Yet if I'm traveling anywhere in these United States, they sympathize and say how tiring it must be. In fact, there are many unique satisfactions here. One is that Americans seem to outstrip every nation for hope. Perhaps because so many of us came in flight from something worse, arose from poverty here or absorbed the fact and fiction of the land of opportunity, or just because optimism itself is contagious, whatever the reason, hopefulness is what I miss the most when I'm not here. It's the thing that makes me glad to come home. After all, hope is a form of planning. However, I'm not suggesting that you travel as much as I have. Like Skye Masterson, the wandering gambler, and Damon Runyon stories, I've been in more hotel rooms than the Gideon Bible. And he didn't wash his hair with hotel soap, eat from vending machines, or sit up late organizing with the hotel maids. After my first 2 decades traveling as an organizer, I realized that the longest stretch I'd spent at home was 8 days. As you can see, I'd fallen in love with the road. My third hope is to share stories. For millennia, we have passed down knowledge through story and song. If you tell me a statistic, I'll make up a story to explain why it's true. Our brains are organized by narrative and image. After I joined the ranks of traveling organizers, which just means being an entrepreneur of social change, I discovered the magic of people telling their own stories to groups of strangers. It's as if attentive people create a magnetic force field for stories the tellers themselves didn't know they had within them. Also, one of the simplest paths to deep change is for the less powerful to speak as much as they listen, and for the more powerful to listen as much as they speak. Perhaps because women are seen as good listeners, I find that a traveling woman, perhaps especially a traveling feminist, becomes a kind of celestial bartender. People say things they wouldn't share with a therapist. As I became more recognizable as part of a movement that gives birth to hope in many people's lives, I became the recipient of even more stories from both women and men. I remember such serendipity as waiting out a storm in a roadhouse that just happened to have a jukebox and a stranded tango teacher who explained the street history of this dance. Hearing Mohawk children as they relearned language and spiritual rituals that had been forbidden for generations. Sitting with a group of Fundamentalist Anonymous as they talked about kicking the drug of certainty. Being interviewed by a 9-year-old girl who was the best player on an otherwise all-boy football team. And meeting a Latina college student, the daughter of undocumented immigrants, who handed me her card. Candidate for the U.S. presidency, 2032. There are also natural gifts of an on-the-road life. For instance, witnessing the northern lights in Colorado, or walking under a New Mexico moon bright enough to reveal the lines in my palm, or hearing the story of a solitary elephant in a Los Angeles zoo, reunited with an elephant friend of many years before. Or finding myself snowed into Chicago with a fireplace, a friend, and a reason to cancel everything. More reliably than anything else on earth, the road will force you to live in the present. My last hope is to open up the road, literally. So far, it's been overwhelmingly masculine turf. Men embody adventure. Women embody hearth and home. And that has been pretty much it. Even as a child, I noticed that Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz spent her entire time trying to get back home to Kansas, and Alice in Wonderland dreamed her long adventure, then woke up just in time for tea. From Joseph Campbell and his hero's journey to Eugene O'Neill's heroes who were kept from the sea by clinging women, I had little reason to think that the road was open to me. In high school, I saw Viva Zapata, the Hollywood version of that great Mexican revolutionary. As Zapata rides to his destiny, his wife hangs on to his boot, dragging in the dust, imploring him to stay home. Since I couldn't yet admit to myself that I was more interested in going to sea and the revolution than in staying home as the mother or the wife, I just vowed silently that I would never become an obstacle to any man's freedom. Even the dictionary defines adventurer as a person who has, enjoys, or seeks adventures. But adventuress is a woman who uses unscrupulous means in order to gain wealth or social position. When women did travel, they seemed to come to a bad end, from the real Amelia Earhart to the fictional Thelma and Louise. In much of the world to this day, a woman may be disciplined or even killed for dishonoring her family if she leaves her home without a male relative, or her country without a male guardian's written permission. In Saudi Arabia, women are still forbidden to drive a car, even to the hospital, in an emergency, much less for an adventure. During the democratic uprisings of the Arab Spring, both female citizens and foreign journalists paid the price of sexual assault for appearing in the public square. As novelist Margaret Atwood wrote to explain women's absence from Quest for Identity novels, there's probably a simple reason for this. Send a woman out alone on a rambling nocturnal quest and she's likely to end up a lot deader, a lot sooner, than a man would. The irony here is that, thanks to molecular archaeology, which includes the study of ancient DNA to trace human movement over time, we now know that men have been the stay-at-homes and women have been the travelers. The rate of intercontinental migration for women is about 8 times that for men. However, these journeys have often been unchosen one-way trips in cultures that were patriarchal and patrilocal. That is, women were under male control and also went to live in their husbands' households. In matrilocal cultures, men joined their wives' families. In about a third of the world, they still do. But with equal status, since those cultures are and almost never were matriarchal. In the face of all the dire and often accurate warnings of danger on the road for women, it took modern feminism to ask the rock-bottom question, compared to what? Whether by dowry murders in India, honor killings in Egypt, or domestic violence in the United States, records show that women are most likely to be beaten or killed at home and by men they know. Statistically speaking, home is an even more dangerous place for women than the road. Perhaps the most revolutionary act for a woman will be a self-willed journey and to be welcomed when she comes home. As you will see, this book is the story not of one or even several trips, but of decades of travel leading out from the hub of home. You might say it's the story of a modern nomad. Besides horizontal travel across the country, you will find two other kinds. Vertical travel into the past of this North American continent that you and I are walking around on, and cultural travel between and among very different people and places. Because this book is all about stories, I hope some here might lead you to tell your own and also to get hooked on the revolutionary act of listening to others. I wish I could imitate the Chinese women letter writers of at least 1,000 years ago. Because they were forbidden to go to school like their brothers, they invented their own script called Nushu, or women's writing, though the punishment for creating a secret language was death. They wrote underground letters and poems of friendship to each other, quite consciously protesting the restrictions of their lives. As one wrote, "Men leave home to brave life in the outside world, but we women are no less courageous. We can create a language they cannot understand." This correspondence was so precious to them that some women were buried with their letters of friendship, yet enough survive for us to see that they wrote in a slender column down the center of each page, leaving wide margins as spaces for a correspondent to add her own words. There have been great societies that did not use the wheel, as Ursula Le Guin wrote, but there have been no societies that did not tell stories. If I could, I would leave an open space for your story on every page.
Chapter 1. My Father's Footsteps. I come by my road habits honestly. There were only a few months each year when my father seemed content with a house-dwelling life. Every summer, We stayed in the small house he had built across the road from a lake in rural Michigan, where he ran a dance pavilion on a pier over the water. Though there was no ocean within hundreds of miles, he had named it Ocean Beach Pier and given it the grandiose slogan, Dancing Over the Water and Under the Stars. On weeknights, people came from nearby farms and summer cottages to dance to a jukebox. My father dreamed up such attractions as a living chess game, inspired by his own love of chess, with costumed teenagers moving across the squares of the dance floor. On weekends, he booked the big dance bands of the 1930s and 1940s into this remote spot. People might come from as far away as Toledo or Detroit to dance to this live music on warm, moonlit nights. Of course, paying the likes of Guy Lombardo or Duke Ellington or the Andrews Sisters meant that one rainy weekend could wipe out a whole summer's profits, so there was always a sense of gambling. I think my father loved that, too. But as soon as Labor Day had ended this precarious livelihood, my father moved his office into his car. In the first warm weeks of autumn, we drove to nearby country auctions, where he searched for antiques amid the household goods and farm tools. After my mother, with her better eye for antiques and her reference books, appraised them for sale, we got into the car again to sell them to roadside antique dealers anywhere within a day's journey. I say we because from the age of four or so, I came into my own as the wrapper and unwrapper of china and other small items that we cushioned in newspaper and carried in cardboard boxes over country roads. Each of us had a role in the family economic unit, including my sister, 9 years older than I, who in the summer sold popcorn from a professional stand my father bought her. But once the first frost turned the lake to crystal and the air above it to steam, my father began collecting road maps from gas stations, testing the trailer hitch on our car, and talking about such faraway pleasures as thin, sugary pralines from Georgia, all-you-can-drink orange juice from roadside stands in Florida, or slabs of salmon fresh from a California smokehouse. Then, one day, as if struck by a sudden whim rather than a lifelong wanderlust, he announced that it was time to put the family dog and other essentials into the house trailer that was always parked in our yard and begin our long trek to Florida or California. Sometimes this leave-taking happened so quickly that we packed more frying pans than plates or left a kitchen full of dirty dishes and half-eaten food to greet us like Pompeii on our return. My father's decision always seemed to come as a surprise, even though his fear of the siren song of home was so great that he refused to put heating or hot water into our small house. If the air of early autumn grew too chilly for us to bathe in the lake, we heated water on a pot-bellied stove and took turns bathing in a big washtub next to the fireplace. Since this required the chopping of wood, an insult to my father's sybaritic soul, he had invented a wood-burning system all his own. He stuck one end of a long log into the fire and let the other protrude into the living room, then kicked it into the fireplace until the whole thing turned to ash. Even a pile of cut firewood in the yard must have seemed to him a dangerous invitation to stay in one place. After he turned his face to the wind, my father did not like to hesitate. Only once do I remember him turning back, and even then, my mother had to argue strenuously that the iron might be burning its way through the ironing board. He would buy us a new radio, new shoes, almost anything, rather than retrace the road already traveled. At the time, I didn't question this spontaneity. It was part of the family ritual. Now, I wonder if seasonal signals might be programmed into the human brain. After all, we've been a migratory species for nearly all our time on Earth, and the idea of a settled life is very new. If birds will abandon their young rather than miss the moment to begin a flight of thousands of miles, what migratory signals might our own cells still hold? Perhaps my father, and even my mother, though she paid a far higher price for our wanderings, had chosen a life in which those signals could still be heard. My parents also lived off the land, in their own way. We never started out with enough money to reach our destination, not even close. Instead, we took a few boxes of china, silver, and other small antiques from those country auctions, and used them to prime the process of buying, selling, and bartering our way along the southern route to California, or still farther south to Florida and the Gulf of Mexico. It was a pattern that had begun years before I was born, and my father knew every roadside dealer in antiques along the way, as a desert traveler knows each oasis. Still, some shops were always new or under new management, and it must have taken courage to drive up in our dusty car and trailer, knowing that we looked less like antique dealers than like migrants forced to sell the family heritage. If a shop owner treated us with too much disdain, my father was not above letting him think we really were selling our possessions. Then he would regain his dignity by elaborating on his triumph once he was back in the car. Since my parents believed that travel was an education in itself, I didn't go to school. My teenage sister enrolled in whatever high school was near our destination, but I was young enough to get away with only my love of comic books, horse stories, and Louisa May Alcott. Reading in the car was so much my personal journey that when my mother urged me to put down my book and look out the window, I would protest, "But I just looked an hour ago." Indeed, it was road signs that taught me to read in the first place. Perfect primers when you think about it. Coffee came with a steaming cup. Hot dogs and hamburgers had illustrations. A bed symbolized hotel, and graphics warned of bridge or road work. There was also the magic of rhyming. A shaving cream company had placed small signs at intervals along the highway, and it was anticipating the rhyme that kept me reading. "If you don't know whose signs these are, you can't have driven very far." Burmishave. Later, when I read that Isaac Dinesen recited English poems to her Kikuyu workers in Kenya, and they requested them over and over again, even though they didn't understand the words, I knew exactly what they meant. Rhyming in itself is magic. In this way, we progressed through rain and sandstorms, heat waves and cold winds, one small part of a migration of American nomads. We ate in diners where I developed a lifetime ambition to run one with blue gingham curtains and bran muffins. In the car during the day, we listened to radio serials and at night to my father singing popular songs to stay awake. I remember driving into the pungent smell of gas stations where men in overalls emerged from under cars, wiping their hands on greasy rags and ushering us into a mysterious and masculine world. Inside were restrooms that were not for the queasy or faint of heart. Outside were ice chests from whose watery depths my father would pluck a Coke, drink it down in one amazing gulp, and then search for a bottle of my beloved knee-high grape soda so I could sip it slowly until my tongue turned purple. The attendants themselves were men of few words, yet they gave freely of their knowledge of the road and the weather, charging only for the gas they sold. I think of them now as tribesmen along a trading route, or suppliers of caravans where the Niger enters the Sahara, or sailmakers serving the spice ships of Trivandrum. And I wonder, were they content with their role, or was this as close to a traveling life as they could come? I remember my father driving on desert roads made of wired together planks, with only an occasional rattlesnake ranch or one pump gas station to break the monotony. We stopped at ghost towns that had been emptied of every living soul and saw sand dunes pushing against lurching buildings, sometimes shifting to reveal a brass post office box or other treasure. I placed my hands on weathered boards trying to imagine the people they once had sheltered, while my parents followed the more reliable route of asking the locals. One town had died slowly after the first asphalt road was laid too far away. Another was emptied by fear when a series of mysterious murders were traced to the sheriff. A third was being repopulated as a stage set for a Western movie starring Gary Cooper, with sagging buildings soaked in kerosene to make an impressive fire, and signs placed everywhere to warn bystanders away. Ever challenged by rules, my father took us down the road to a slack place in the fence and sneaked us onto the set. Perhaps assuming that we had permission from higher-ups, the crew treated us with deference. I still have a photo my father took of me standing a few feet from Gary Cooper, who was looking down at me with amusement, my head at about the height of his knee, my worried gaze fixed on the ground. As a child who wanted too much to fit in, I worried that we would be abandoned like those towns one day, or that my father's rule-breaking would bring down some nameless punishment. But now I wonder, without those ghost towns that live in my imagination longer than any inhabited place, would I have known that mystery leaves a space for us when certainty does not? And would I have dared to challenge rules later in life if my father had obeyed them? Whenever we were flush, we traded the cold concrete showers of trailer parks for taking turns at a hot bath in a motel. Afterward, we often went to some local movie palace, a grand and balconied place that was nothing like the Warrens of viewing rooms today. My father was always sure that a movie and a malted could cure anything, and he wasn't wrong. We would cross the sidewalk that sparkled with mica, enter the gilded lobby with fountains where moviegoers threw pennies for luck and future return, and leave our cares behind. In that huge, dark space filled with strangers, all facing huge and glowing images, we gave ourselves up to another world. Now I know that both the palaces and the movies were fantasies created by Hollywood in the Depression, the only adventures most people could afford. I think of them again whenever I see subway riders lost in paperback mysteries, the kind that Stephen King's waitress mother once called her cheap, sweet vacations, and so he writes them for her still. I think of them when I see children cramming all five senses into virtual images online, or when I pass a house topped by a satellite dish almost as big as it is, as if the most important thing were the ability to escape. The travel writer Bruce Chatwin wrote that our nomadic past lives on in our need for distraction, our mania for the new. In many languages, even the word for human being is one who goes on migrations. Progress itself is a word rooted in a seasonal journey. Perhaps our need to escape into media is a misplaced desire for the journey. Most of all, from my childhood travels, I remember the first breath of salt air as we neared our destination. On a California highway overlooking the Pacific, or a Florida causeway that cut through the Gulf of Mexico like Moses parting the Red Sea, we would get out of our cramped car, stretch, and fill our lungs in an ontogeny of birth. Melville once said that every path leads to the sea, the source of all life. That conveys the fatefulness of it, but not the joy. Years later, I saw a movie about a prostituted woman in Paris who saves money to take her young daughter on a vacation by the sea. As their train full of workers rounds a cliff, the shining, limitless waters spread out beneath them, and suddenly all the passengers begin to laugh, throw open the windows, and toss out cigarettes, coins, lipstick, everything they thought they needed a moment before. This was the joy I felt as a wandering child. Whenever the road presents me with its greatest gift, a moment of unity with everything around me, I still do. Another truth of my early wanderings is harder to admit. I longed for a home. It wasn't a specific place, but a mythical, neat house with conventional parents, a school I could walk to, and friends who lived nearby. My dream bore a suspicious resemblance to the life I saw in movies, but my longing for it was like a constant, low-level fever. I never stopped to think that children in neat houses and conventional schools might envy me. When I was 10 or so, my parents separated. My sister was devastated, but I had never understood why two such different people were married in the first place. My mother often worried her way into depression, and my father's habit of mortgaging the house or otherwise going into debt without telling her didn't help. Also, wartime gas rationing had forced Ocean Beach Pier to close, and my father was on the road nearly full-time, buying and selling jewelry and small antiques to make a living. He felt he could no longer look after my sometimes incapacitated mother. Also, she wanted to live near my sister, who was finishing college in Massachusetts, and now I was old enough to be her companion. We rented a house in a small town and spent most of one school year there. It was the most conventional life we would ever lead. After my sister graduated and left for her first grown-up job, my mother and I moved to East Toledo and an ancient farmhouse where her family had once lived. As with all inferior things, this part of the city was given an adjective while the rest stole the noun. What once had been countryside was crowded with the small houses of factory workers. They surrounded our condemned and barely habitable house on three sides, with a major highway undercutting its front porch and trucks that rattled our windows. Inside this remnant of her childhood, my mother disappeared more and more into her unseen and unhappy world. I was always worried that she might wander into the streets or forget that I was in school and call the police to find me, all of which sometimes happened. Still, I thought I was concealing all this from my new friends. Most were quiet about their families for some reason, from speaking only Polish or Hungarian at home to a father who drank too much or an out-of-work relative sleeping on the couch. By tacit agreement, we tended to meet on street corners. Only many years later would I meet a high school classmate who confessed that she had always worried about me, that my mother was called the crazy lady of the neighborhood. During those years, my mother told me more about her early life. Long before I was born, she had been a rare and pioneering woman reporter, work that she loved and had done so well that she was promoted from social reporting to Sunday editor for a major Toledo newspaper. She had stayed on this path for a decade after marrying my father and 6 years after giving birth to my sister. She was also supporting her husband's impractical dreams and debts, suffering a miscarriage and then a stillbirth, and falling in love with a man at work. Perhaps the man she should have married. All this ended in so much self-blame and guilt that she suffered what was then called a nervous breakdown, spent 2 years in a sanitarium, and emerged with an even greater feeling of guilt for having left my sister in her father's care. She also had become addicted to a dark liquid sedative called chloral hydrate. Without it, she could be sleepless for days and hallucinate. With it, her speech was slurred and her attention slowed. Once out of the sanitarium, my mother gave up her job, her friends, and everything she loved to follow my father to isolated rural Michigan, where he was pursuing his dream of building a summer resort. In this way, she became the mother I knew, kind and loving, with flashes of humor and talent in everything from math to poetry, yet also without confidence or stability. While I was living with her in Toledo, my father was driving around the Sun Belt, living almost entirely in his car. Once each summer, he drove back to the Midwest for a visit, his timing always dependent on his mysterious deals. He once wrote me about a short story whose principal character was always waiting for the big deal. A story he said could have been about him. Between visits, he sent postcards signed Pop, $50 monthly money orders tucked into various motel envelopes, and letters written on his idea of business stationery, a heavy, ragged-edged paper without address or his first name, which was Leo, just at the top in big exploding red letters, "It's dynamite." This way of life ended when I was 17. And our Toledo house was sold as a teardown for a parking lot, a sale my mother had long planned so I would have money to pay for college. My sister came during my father's visit that summer because she had a plan. If he would take responsibility for our mother for a year, I could live with my sister in Washington, D.C., where she was a jewelry buyer in a department store. This would give me a carefree senior year of high school. I told my sister that our father would never do it, and when the three of us went out for breakfast together, this was exactly what he said. After she stormed out in anger, my father drove me to my summer job as a sales girl. Opening the car door to go to work, I surprised us both by starting to cry. I had no idea that a ray of hope had crept in. Because he couldn't bear to see anyone cry, certainly not the daughter he'd known mostly as a child, he reluctantly said okay, but only if we synchronized our watches to exactly 1 year. Somehow my father did manage to take care of my mother, even while driving around California from one motel to the next. I had a glorious year finishing high school, getting sympathy for being without my parents, and secretly feeling free. When our father brought our mother to Washington to live with my sister and me, and after I left for college in the fall, my sister realized she couldn't both work and be a full-time caregiver. Instead, she found a kind-hearted doctor at a mental hospital near Baltimore who admitted our mother as a resident and began to give her some of the help she should have had years before. When I visited her there on weekends from my summer job and then on college vacations, I slowly began to meet someone I'd never known. I discovered that we were alike in many ways, something I either hadn't seen or couldn't admit out of fear that I would share her fate. I learned that the poems I remembered her reciting by heart were by Edna St. Vincent Millay and Omar Khayyam, that teaching me to fold a sheet of typing paper into three columns for note-taking had been sharing a tool of her journalistic trade, and that she had wanted with all her heart to leave my father and go with a girlfriend to try their luck as journalists in New York. As I looked into her brown eyes, I saw for the first time how much they were like my own. If I pressed and said, "But why didn't you leave? Why didn't you take my sister and go to New York?" she would say it didn't matter, that she was lucky to have my sister and me. If I pressed hard enough, she would add, "If I'd left, you never would have been born." I never had the courage to say, "But you would have been born instead." At college, I lived in a dormitory, happy to be responsible for no one but myself. I think my classmates were mystified by my wall-to-wall cheerfulness and mistook it for some odd Midwestern trait. I spent an undergraduate year in Europe, pretending to study while actually traveling, because I was sure I would never get to Europe again. After graduation, I lived for a summer with my mother, who was well enough to live first in a rooming house, then with my sister, who had married and created an apartment for our mother in her home. Then I went to India on a fellowship and spent nearly 2 years there wandering and writing. But at home again, I couldn't find a job that used what I had learned there. I wandered more, worked in student politics, and finally began to make a freelance living as a writer in New York, always in the familiar land of the temporary. I found an apartment and a roommate, but kept on living out of boxes and suitcases. In city streets, I often looked into lighted windows and repeated the mantra of my childhood, "Everybody has a home but me." Meanwhile, my mother worked part-time in a gift shop near where she lived with my sister and pursued interests that included Eastern philosophy and an Episcopalian church she loved because it allowed the homeless to sleep in its pews. She would never be able to live on her own, but when she visited me in New York, she seemed both proud and scared that I was where she had once wished to be. I learned from my father's postcards that he had revisited his show business dreams by buying the contract of a young Italian pop singer. He drove the singer and his wife to gigs at bars and roadhouses, but the singer got few callbacks, made no records, and according to my father, ate a lot, as did his wife. My father sent him back to his job at an aircraft factory and became a solitary traveler again. When he heard that semi-precious stones could be bought on the cheap in Latin America, he financed a trip by selling his car. However, when he arrived in Ecuador, he encountered an earthquake, few bargains, and a woman from Germany who wanted to marry a U.S. citizen in order to enter this country, something he didn't confide in me until after they were divorced. He also made the sole personal comment of our lifetime together. You know how people say you lose interest in sex after 60? Well, it isn't true. When he discovered he would be financially responsible for his ex-wife in this country, he urged her to return and come back on her own, which he was lucky she was willing to do. Altogether, he ended his Latin American adventure more broke than when he began. Later, this woman who was so briefly my stepmother called to ask me where she could send my father a birthday card. I'd lived apart from him so long that I'd forgotten my childhood training to never, ever say more than, "Daddy isn't home." After all, the caller might be a bill collector. It's amazing how fast one can learn a way of life and how fast one can forget it. I actually told her where to write him. This caused my usually soft-hearted father to shout at me from a faraway payphone, "How could you?" He was sure she only wanted money. Yet on his annual trips east, my father was his usual cheerful, good-hearted self. He worried about only two things. Avoiding the IRS, he hadn't paid taxes or even filed a return in years, and dealing with minor health problems that plagued him. At over 300 pounds, he had what he jokingly called very close veins, plus difficulty moving anywhere outside his car like a whale out of water. Nonetheless, he never stopped patronizing the best ice cream places and every all-you-can-eat restaurant from coast to coast, or driving even to the corner to mail a letter. And he never gave up on his dreams and deals. Once, he swore me to secrecy about his idea for a roadside chain called Santana Motels. Each unit would have a retractable roof that guests could crank back and sunbathe in privacy. Another time he told me about a highly confidential formula for an orange drink that would rival Orange Julius. Mostly, he sent slogans to ad agencies, by registered mail so no one could steal them. For example, "You can bet your bottom dollar on Scott Tissue." Or, "If you're a chain smoker, make every link old gold." When his ideas weren't accepted, he just thought of more. After I graduated from college with a Phi Beta Kappa key, he worried about my fate as an overeducated woman. He thought a college degree was nice, but unnecessary for either one of us. He once sent me an ad from Variety, his show business bible, that called for women under 24, over 5'7", with a Phi Beta Kappa key, to dance in a Las Vegas chorus line to be called the High Phi Betas. Scrawled across the clipping, he had written in red, "Kid," which was the way he always addressed me. "This is perfect for you." After I went off to India instead, he had another idea. He sent me $800 to buy a star sapphire on my return trip through Burma. He would meet me when my boat docked in San Francisco and sell the stone for a profit that would subsidize our drive back east in style. When I emerged along with 300 Chinese immigrants from steerage, the cheapest way home, he met me with his jeweler's loop. Right away, he saw that I'd picked a lopsided star. When I was in college, he had improved on my short-lived engagement ring by dipping it in water made bluish by swishing an indelible pencil, thus making a yellowish diamond look white. Yet this star problem was something he couldn't fix. He knew he would be lucky to get his money back. Rolling with the punches, he offered to introduce me to a friend who made aerosol cans and might employ me to sell this new invention on the road. I would get paid for traveling, in my father's eyes, the best of all worlds. When I didn't say yes to that either, he said he had enough gas and food money to get us to Las Vegas. I asked worriedly what would happen then, and he said, "Then you'll be lucky at the one-armed bandits, beginners always are, and you can help me sell jewelry on the road back east." In a windowless Las Vegas casino filled with silent gamblers and noisy slot machines, He staked me to a $50 bucket of coins. After a couple of hours of twirling fruits and no idea what I was doing, I'd multiplied our money by five. Only then did he confess this had been his last $50. To celebrate, we stuffed ourselves with the food kept cheap to attract gamblers, saw a free show by his tried-and-true method of walking in after it was well underway,